Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association.
This is episode 75 of Text Messages, Still Worth Reading. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. As someone who's been a steady reader of young adult literature for the past 20 years, I can't help but marvel at the current popularity of books for teens. Certainly movies based on YA novels are part of the equation. You'd be hard-pressed to find many people who haven't heard of blockbuster hits like The Hunger Games, Divergent, or The Fault in Our Stars. But there's more going on here than Hollywood exposure. When young adult authors are being interviewed on NPR and profiled in The New Yorker, and when debates about diversity in teen lit are trending on Twitter, you know there's something shifting in our culture. Adults and teens alike are taking note of these books. More people are buying and reading them than ever before. Given the current level of energy and enthusiasm for young adult literature, now is a good time to pause and look beyond current bestsellers to older, lesser-known titles, that is, young adult novels from the past that never grabbed the popular culture spotlight but are still worth reading. These books, published in the late 1980s and early 1990s, have always had their fans. When I was a high school English teacher, many of them were favorites of teen librarians on the YALSA book listserv and students in my ninth grade classroom. Still, it's all too easy for them to get lost or forgotten in today's overcrowded YA market. You may have to do a little digging in order to find these backlist titles, but once you take stock of their quality and variety, you'll be glad you did. Some are traditional coming-of-age stories. Others incorporate magical realism or dark psychological suspense. You'll find an epistolary novel and a punk rock fairy tale. You'll also find allusions to classic literature and popular culture. Some alternate points of view, others alternate between events in the present and events in the past. But what binds them all together, across their various plot structures and styles, is heart. These are books that introduce you to main characters you'll love and want to protect as they struggle to find their way in the world. Because the stories are emotionally honest, they remind us that the process of figuring out who you are is always some combination of beautiful and painful, no matter what the time period. I'll begin the show with two novels featuring teen boys at the end of high school. Both are on my list of all-time favorites, mainly because they tell the truth about senior year. Beyond parties and prom, questions about the future loom for kids who are seniors, and the way forward may be anything but clear. Barbara Shoup nails this feeling of emotional drift in her 1994 novel, Wish You Were Here. Main character Jackson has been told all his life that he's a good kid. Like a lot of teens his age, he's a product of divorce, but he's held it together. His best friend Brady has always advised him on how to cope. The important thing is, don't ever tell them what you think, Brady says. What you want to do is figure out what they want you to say and say that. Otherwise, they'll freak out and send you to a shrink. So Jax has gone along, joining his dad on crazy road trips from their home in Indianapolis to places like the Etch-a-Sketch Factory and the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame, while reassuring his mom that everything is fine. Brady's the one who comes up with the idea to get an apartment for senior year. Convincing their parents to say yes turns out to be easy. Jax's parents are too engrossed in their own lives to object, and Brady's parents just want him out of the house. But when an argument with his dad sends Brady into a rage, he trashes his dad's place. Then he runs away. Just like that, Jax's plan for senior year falls apart. The kids say Brady's off following the Grateful Dead, but Jax feels lost and hurt. His dad tells him he can't wait around for Brady, but what else is there to do? I first read Wish You Were Here 20 years ago. Rereading the book today, Jax is as deep and soulful as he was the day I met him. He's a normal kid going through normal senior year stuff, sometimes messing up, sometimes doing right. I still can't listen to the band REM without thinking about him and Brady. I think what I love most about Jax is how he reminds us that the good kids need help finding their way just as much as everyone else does. No one would peg the main character of Rats Saw God, the 1996 novel by Rob Thomas, as a good kid. When we first meet Steve York, he's sitting in his counselor's office and he is stoned. Steve is one of those kids who always has a clever comeback, and he's much savvier than Jax at the practiced art of not caring. But there's something odd about Steve's situation. He's a new student in a San Diego high school with a file full of absences, disciplinary referrals, and lousy grades. But alongside his file, there's also a letter on his counselor's desk notifying the school that he's just been named a National Merit finalist. What happened in Texas? His counselor wants to know. Steve's not telling, but clearly something happened. What causes a kid who had a 4.0 for 5 semesters and near-perfect attendance to fail English at the end of junior year, then move across the country to live with his mom? His counselor makes him a deal. Write a 100-page paper, earn back the lost English credit, and graduate on time. Grudgingly, and only to avoid summer school, Steve begins to write. And that's how we get to know the real Steve York, son of the famous astronaut, and his nonconformist group of friends back in Houston. Steve takes subversive pleasure in his hoop earrings and do-rag. They drive his uptight father crazy. He finds safe haven in his girlfriend, Dub, and a renegade club called the Grace Order of Dadaists. But beneath the cool exterior is a vulnerable kid who's convinced he'll never live up to his father's expectations. And when everything falls apart, somehow he has to find a way to put it back together again. What I've always loved about Rats Saw God is its blend of humor and pathos. Steve York is the kind of kid who makes you smile even as you're figuring out his punishment. He's too smart to go along and too odd to fit in. Listeners should know that this book contains one of the funniest and most disastrous first sex scenes ever written. Steve's voice may be one of the snarkiest you'll come across in YA Lit. You feel for him, though, just like you feel for Jax, because you understand how teenagers' hearts get broken and you want to see them recover. I'll turn now to a pair of books where the main characters are girls and the story is about friendship. The first is John Marsden's 1994 novel, Letters from the Inside. If you aren't familiar with the name John Marsden, you'll want to look him up right away. His Tomorrow When the War Began series made him one of Australia's most popular YA authors during the 1990s, and that fame was well earned. Whenever you read a John Marsden book, you know you're going to get complex characters, page-turning suspense, and somewhere along the line, a major plot twist. All of those things are true about Letters from the Inside, even though the book starts off as an ordinary pen pal story. The first letter comes from Mandy, who introduces herself and then wonders why she answered Tracy's ad. Tracy writes back, saying she put the ad in for a joke, but now that Mandy's replied, she hopes they can keep writing. Out of this tentative beginning, a friendship forms. Casual exchanges about pets and school soon turn to deeper topics, their families and fears. Somehow, each girl is able to say things in letters that she wouldn't say in person. Mandy and Tracy define themselves and try to define each other through the things they write. But some details are hard to explain. What is it about Mandy's brother that makes him so scary? And why do Tracy's letters take so long to get through? Who are these two girls, really? Which parts of their letters are true, and which are lies? Letters from the Inside was the most shocking and suspenseful book I read as an early career English teacher. Ninth graders both loved it and hated it. The legendary YA author Robert Cormier called it unforgettable. Beyond its psychological intensity, it's also a meditation on writing, a look at what our words reveal and what they conceal, even from ourselves. Readers who managed to track down a copy of DeVita Wills Herwin's 1997 novel, A Time for Dancing, will soon learn that books about teens with cancer have been devastating readers for years. like Letters from the Inside, A Time for Dancing is written in alternating points of view. Samantha and Julie have been best friends for more than half their lives. They're committed to dance and each other. Nothing can come between them. Then Julie starts to feel pain in her back and hip. If you dance, you expect to hurt, but this pain persists. The doctors can't diagnose it until one day they do. It's cancer. Today, any book about cancer is going to live in the shadow of The Fault in Our Stars. Readers will want to know how A Time for Dancing is the same and how it is different from John Green's book. There are several good answers to that question. First of all, Herwin's novel is about the devastation of discovering cancer and then learning to live with it. It's about watching your best friend grow weak and die, and the particular form of helplessness that brings on. It's about the impact of cancer on other people, your best friend, your parents, your little sister. Finally, it's about reconciling yourself with the reality that you aren't going to get better, even when your doctor tells you otherwise. It's about letting go and dying, but it's also about transcendence and grace. The next set of books I want to tell you about explore the difficulties of romantic love. The oldest book in this Smut Show, Jenny Davis' 1998 novel Sex Education, is a book I might never have read if I hadn't discovered it at the Friends of the Ann Arbor Library book sale. My paperback copy is so old, the spine is broken and the pages are falling out, but I will never get rid of this book. It's partly the story of an unusual teacher named Mrs. Fulton, who chooses to begin her ninth grade biology class with a unit on sex ed. That layer itself is wonderful, and it's because of Mrs. Fulton. She's uncomfortable and awkward, but she's determined to talk openly with teens about sex. Her homework assignments include tasks like think about sex and look at your body in the mirror and don't judge it. The kids think this is weird, but they buy in. Then there's the caring project. Find someone to care about, Mrs. Fulton tells them. Sex has to do with caring, she says. Think of this as practice. Caring proves to be central to the plot and the theme of Sex Education. From the first page of this beautiful book, we learn that something about caring went horribly wrong in the life of main character Livy. That's because she's writing about what happened from inside a psych hospital. She begins, "This is a story I would rather not tell, but Hirsch says I must, and Hirsch is my doctor. He says there is healing in telling, telling even the worst, but what he doesn't understand is that I don't want to get well." So we read to find out what happened to Livy and to David, the boy she meets on the first day of ninth grade when she is a new student trying to get her bearings in Mrs. Fulton's class. They become partners in the Caring Project, and their lives are forever changed because of it. At its core, Sex Education is a love story, less about sex than about the unforeseen risks attached to caring. Like other books in this show, Livy's first-person voice is arresting and raw. Be warned that this is a sad book, but the sadness is worth it. Sometimes love stories are about falling in love with a person you can't have. One of my favorite takes on this subject is Ellen Whitlinger's 1999 novel, Hard Love. In my life as a reader, stories of unrequited love almost always involve a girl pining for a boy who either doesn't know she exists or is already committed to someone else. Hard Love is different in several wonderful ways. First of all, the main character is a boy. John tells us on the first page that he's immune to emotion, but that's not entirely true. He has a passion in life, and it's for zines, those handmade magazines young people made in the 1990s and filled with clip art, photos, and lots of personal writing. John writes one called Banana Fish, but the zine he really loves is Escape Velocity. It's written by a girl named Marisol, and he gets his copies at the Tower Record Store on Newberry Street in Boston. In fact, he's such a fan, he makes a point of showing up on delivery day so he can meet Marisol in person. She's angry and unimpressed. "What are you, trying to pick me up?" she yells. "I told you, I'm a lesbian." But that doesn't matter to John. He just wants someone to talk to. he persists, and they begin a wary friendship rooted in their shared love of writing. From the beginning, Marisol challenges John. Stop hiding, she says. Stop lying. Stop going through life not caring. She pulls him out of his shell, and of course, he falls in love with her. 15 years after the publication date, Hard Love is still one of the best LGBTQ books I've ever read. Marisol is strong and independent, certain of who she is in ways that John will probably never be. He knows better than to try to change her, and yet he tries anyway. The results are predictably funny and miserable. Fortunately for John, Hard Love is about hanging on, even when you'll never be able to have the love you want. It's an ode to finding yourself through writing and through connecting with another person. Another book that explores the conflicts that arise when straight teens realize a loved one is gay is Jacqueline Woodson's 1995 novel From the Notebooks of Melanin Sun. At this point, Jacqueline Woodson is well on her way to becoming another one of our YA legends. This is one of her earliest books, contemplative, voice-filled, and lovely. Main character Melanin Sun is one of those quiet kids. He wishes he was more talkative, and he wishes he could slam dunk, but that's not him. He's a listener and an observer. What he can't say, he writes in his notebooks. His mom gets that. She gets everything about him. Ever since he was born, it's been the two of them, close and connected. But something's changing during the summer when Melanin's 13. His mom says there's someone she wants him to meet. He's been through this before, watching his mom date men who come and go. The last thing Mel expects is for this person, this special someone, to be a woman. Even worse, to be a white woman. In order to hold on to his mom, Melanin is forced to deal with Kristen, and with the fact that his mom is gay. But he hates it, every part of it. He hates having to listen to his friends taunt him about having a dyke for a mom. He hates being the target of neighborhood gossip. He even hates having to have a white person in his home. He was never welcome in the white world, he thinks, so why should he open his world to them? I said at the start of this show that along with heart, honesty is what ties these books together. From the Notebooks of Melanin Sun is honest about some of the most difficult problems we face as a culture and as individuals, homophobia and racism. Sometimes being honest involves being ugly, and Melanin Sun says some pretty ugly things as he struggles to understand this new part of his mom. Once those things are out in the open, however, you can deal with them. Melanin Sun opens the door for conversations that are as necessary today as they were when it was first published. Definitely a book that's still worth reading. The last two books I want to tell you about are classic novels by classic authors, but they still may be new to today's YA readers. The first is Robert Cormier's The Rag and Bone Shop, published posthumously in 2001. Truly one of the giants of our field, Robert Cormier showed readers that YA lit could be serious and literary, and that it could also be dark. One of Cormier's signature moves was to explore human evil as well as human goodness through his stories. In books like The Chocolate War and I Am the Cheese, both published in the 1970s, he urged teens to recognize abuse of power and stand against it. What made his books controversial is that the good guy usually lost. Given this tradition, The Rag and Bone Shop provides fitting closure to Cormier's life's work. Readers should know that even though The Rag and Bone Shop is short, and main character Jason is only 12, this is not a book for younger readers. Here's why. When the story begins, a 7-year-old girl, Alicia, has been found murdered in the woods. As the last person to see her alive, Jason is a key suspect. It doesn't matter that he was fond of this girl. It doesn't matter that he is repeatedly questioned without a lawyer present to advise him of his rights. When a little girl gets killed, a community wants answers, and sometimes the authorities will do whatever it takes to close the case. The Rag & Bone Shop is a psychological thriller that brings us inside the minds of the suspect, Jason, and his interrogator, Trent, a man known for being able to get a confession out of anyone. Haunting lines from a poem by Yeats provide the novel's title and its refrain. I must lie down where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. Like most other works by Cormier, this is a story that will disturb and upset readers. But if you're looking for psychological complexity and an honest portrait of flaws in the human psyche, it's a book that demands to be read. Last but not least, I have to tell you about Francesca Leah Block's beloved YA cult classic, Wheatsy Bat. First published in 1989, Wheatsy Bat ushered in a new era of innovation in young adult literature. Critics had never seen anything like it, and really, that's still true today. No one writes like Francesca Leah Block. In this tiny little book, the city of Los Angeles is like a living, breathing character. Main character Wheatsy Bat adores everything about L.A., from the matinee movies on Hollywood Boulevard to the burritos at Okie Dogs. She wears a bleach blonde flat top and pink harlequin sunglasses. Her best friend Dirk wears black leather and a mohawk. Together they go to clubs. They dance and dive into mosh pits. They say they are duck hunting, which means they are each looking for the right boy to fall in love with. And that's what Wheatsy Bat is really about, the quest for love in a tainted world. This is a book that tells readers you have to be brave to believe in love, but that fairy tales and happy endings are still possible. Even in the face of nuclear accidents and crazy psychos and disease, you hold on to hope. So when Dirk's grandma Fifi gives Wheatsy a magic lamp, and the genie inside grants her three wishes, she asks for a duck for Dirk, my secret agent lover man for her, and a beautiful little house for them to live in happily ever after. From then on, the story is about the life they all build together. If you aren't sure what to make of this odd blend of magic and realism, you're not alone. But believe me when I tell you that it works. That's because Wheatsy and her friends are both innocent and worldly. If you think about it, wishing for happily ever after, at a time when the gay community was being ravaged by AIDS, is an extremely brave thing to do. Love is a dangerous angel, Dirk tells Wheatsy. As we've seen in so many of the books for this show, it's risky to love, and caring is hard. Wheatsy Bat shows the darkness and beauty of that in a story that shimmers with poetic language. Read it, and then read it again. You'll find something new every time. I hope you will read these books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Next month, I'll be back with a collection of YA titles that explore life after high school. Whether it's heading off to college or going some other route, each of these books feature teen characters who are doing the difficult work of figuring out their lives and making their way into adulthood. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller. More episodes of Text Messages are available at readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening and look forward to more Text Messages soon.